You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
Hello, folks, and welcome to PyReps. PyReps is a show dedicated to educating, informing, and piquing the interests of the flying public, student pilots, new private pilots, and anyone interested in the world of general and commercial aviation. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of PyReps. I'm Private Pilot Phil, and with me is First Officer Brian Johnson and our special guest, Ground Instructor Bazzy. Hello, Bazzy.
Hey, how are you? How's it going?
First Officer Johnson, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic. How about you?
I'm hanging in there. I'm not getting any taller, I can tell you that much. So today we're going to talk about some flight school information. Ground Instructor Bazzy works for one of the flight schools in Southeast Lower Michigan, and he does ground instruction. You do IFR and VFR?
Yes.
Okay. So tell us your journey to reaching your point of becoming a ground instructor.
Well, I certainly started flying at the age of 16 or so, but it's always been a childhood dream, as I've always wanted to fly. And then went through school, went to a couple flight schools in, you know, the United States. Then came back here and just got the job as an instructor. And then I'm working towards other ratings right now at this point. So it's definitely been a long journey, but it's been definitely a childhood dream, and still continuing through it and making sure that I get what I need to get to. And then, you know, from there, just take a step up. I would like to always continue as an instructor, no matter what I do in aviation, because I think it's definitely been it's a rewarding feeling to see other people that you teach become pilots or learn something. And it's to see their journey was always been interesting. And I loved being around the training aspect of flying always, because I felt that you had to always enjoy your journey. A lot of people don't get to enjoy it. They want to get there. But flying is a lot of fun. Learning to fly is a lot of fun. And I see it now more than ever as being on the other side. It's definitely rewarding, and it's definitely been a really great experience for me. And I've learned a lot, and I hope I will continue to learn. And it's been definitely rewarding for sure.
So explain to us what a ground instructor does. Now, you have to have a lot of areas of expertise in doing that. So explain to us, like, let's say, do you train VFR and IFR students?
Yeah, I mean, each rating has each instrument, or let's say a private rating has, you have to do certain ground school requirements. Generally, there's a test that you have to take, which is required by the FAA. It's basically a written test. And we prepare them for the written test. We also prepare them to make sure that they are their knowledge is good as far as the training's concerned. It goes through, weather, for example, navigation. There's all kinds of topics we have to cover in ground school. And then I try to also, in addition to just having the minimums done, I've noticed that I do extra, a little bit of extra stuff that I can bring as far as an instructor to the table, as far as flying wise, that helps the students, because I've seen in the last couple months or so that I've been doing these extra things, the ground or the knowledge base for the students has increased a lot. And it's really helped them a lot, because a lot of people or students don't put, they just want to fly, right? We always just want to fly. So it's very important that we focus on the ground aspect of things. And I've been doing that. I've seen a huge increase of knowledge for the students. We cover all kinds of areas as far as the flight planning, weather, navigation, airplane systems. And each rating has its own requirements to get your license. And it's really been a great experience.
Oh, great. So, well, we're going to start off with some questions here that we've had, if I'm speaking into the mic correctly.
Yep.
Interesting questions here that we get on the email.
Yep.
Some of our listeners, we had mentioned that you were going to come on the next show, so mm-hmm. We have some coming in. Some are interesting questions. So are you ready?
Go ahead, man. Go for it.
Okay. Hey, you're the expert, man. It's been so long since I flight instructed.
We're all experts, no?
Yeah. Well, but I mean,
not me so much. I'm kind of behind in the times.
It's been so long since I've instructed.
Yeah, and the thing is, I really want to just kind of put forward in all this is that today is that, as you know from your experience, mm-hmm. a lot of people, they just want to fly.
Sure.
They don't want to spend a lot of time on ground stuff. But the more you prepare, I tell students, on the ground, first of all, the less it's going to cost you. Because when you come prepared to flight training, it really helps. Like an airplane is not a good classroom, for example. So that really, I've seen, has really helped a lot. A lot of students just kind of get that, you know, knowledge in there. I just really want to stretch that for either student pilots or future pilots. It really will reduce your cost if you just do the studying ahead of time.
Yeah. And that's
good
why
show.
I was just going to say, that's why I think it's so important that we have ground instructors like you in the community, because like you said, it's easy to get motivated about doing the flying portion, but not as many people are as motivated to do the ground portion, even though it's just as important to be knowledgeable in a lot of the ground related topics for flying. So to have knowledgeable subject matter experts like yourself, who, like you said, can not only meet the FAA minimums for the minimum amount of knowledge that you're looking to pass on, but going above and beyond to give the students extra knowledge to make sure that they know everything they need to know to be safe is very important.
Yeah.
So,
agrees, 100%.
Sounds good. Okay, so we're going to the first question.
Go ahead.
Are you ready? Now, you're familiar with the Salem VOR.
Yes.
Okay, very good, because you and I have tracked to it. And, using, you know, one delta two and everything.
Yep.
Okay. This question is, what is the elevation of the Salem VOR and mean sea level?
Do you know that off top of your head?
I want to say isn't it 955 feet MSL, I believe. I think it is.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Well, interesting question. Never had to think about that. That's pretty cool though.
Yeah.
Kind of off the wall one.
Yeah, that was cool.
Yeah.
Surprised.
A lot
I
of these are.
I'm surprised they actually knew that.
Yeah. Well, it's just, you know, it's in the it used to call it the airport facility directory.
Right, right.
Now it's the chart supplement. And as instructors, we used to be required to know that back in the day. So I'm just actually honestly surprised I remembered it.
Yeah.
It can be important because, you know, the with elevation varying.
Sure.
You wouldn't want, like, if you're doing a cross-country flight, you'd want to know the elevation not only of the departure and destination airport, but also the nav aids and the waypoints along the way, because that would determine your terrain clearance,
sure,
which would have an effect on your desired cruising altitude.
Absolutely. I don't know if that thing is still operational, but...
It is. It's still... The Salem VOR is operational. I know Pontiac is not in service anymore. They're slowly phasing them out, but they're still not – like Salem's definitely been still used as far as I know at this point.
Fascinating. Okay, here's the next one. Are you ready?
Yes. Is this like a quiz or something?
It seems like it, doesn't it? When I read some of these, it almost is, really is. Technically, it is. All right, Ground Instructor Badsy, the next one. Are you ready?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, what is the latitude and longitude down to the minute of Oakland International Airport?
Man, down to the minute?
Yes, sir.
Who are coming up with these questions?
I have no idea. It's my first time here.
Yeah, I don't know.
Let me say, we've got some very intelligent listeners. If you guys
I would say, they should be. I don't know. What would be the, what's the, I have to look that up.
I thought if anybody would know, it'd be you. I want to say it's like, what is it? Well, you do, normally there's a standard format that you follow when you list latitude and longitude. Normally you list latitude first, followed by longitude.
Yep.
And for us, we're roughly, for Oakland County International Airport, it'd be at roughly 42 degrees north latitude, 39 minutes. And I want to say about 83 degrees west longitude, 25 minutes. And so that coordinate system varies.
How did you
figure out? I know that was pretty good.
It varies for different airports. Again, that's one of those things where when you now I've got the benefit of flying a lot.
Sure.
You know, I fly for a living. So on our charts, we're constantly inputting latitudes and longitudes
into our flight management systems.
And
that's also a very good point, is that even being a ground instructor, there are some things that, if I have not to experience it, I wouldn't know. So the fact that you just mentioned, you know, I input this all the time, that they really shows that, you know, you can definitely do that. But yeah, those are some interesting questions you got there, I must say.
Yeah, some are just interesting here. The other one, are you ready again?
Oh, man. Okay go ahead.
You never know. I mean, during your ground instruction, you might have one of these. You know?
I haven't had those yet. I have not anybody asked me the Salem one or the other one. So
okay,
yeah,
what,
I've got some like that a couple times before.
The other one here is what are the limit load factors for utility category aircraft in positive?
Oh, that's a good one.
Is it 3.5 now?
No, it's 4.4.
Okay.
And negative.
You know, I don't know the answer to that.
-1.76. Yeah. So the
see, you guys are brilliant. I'll tell you,
the limit load factors are in place because the engineers that design aircraft design them to only be able to withstand a certain amount of load factor.
Sure.
And load factor is a factor of acceleration. So anytime the airplane's in curving flight, it's going to experience the force of gravity multiplied by a given factor. So if you've ever been like on a roller coaster, for example, our listeners out there, and you notice that when a roller coaster makes a dip or a turn or goes back up at the bottom of the hill, you feel heavier. In reality, you're not heavier, but because of the force of acceleration, you feel heavier. So sure. Load factor is a ratio of lift over weight, and it's expressed in G's. So if you're, let's say, making a 60-degree bank turn and experiencing 2 G's, you'll feel 2 times as heavy, and the aircraft has to support twice as much weight. So for utility category aircraft, which a lot of your typical trainers will be, Cessna 152s, 172s, your Piper Cherokee, for example, they're built to withstand positive 4.4 G's and negative 1.76 G's, which gives you a pretty good margin because when you think about it, these aren't acrobatic airplanes.
Sure.
You shouldn't be doing in normal flight anything more than 45 to 60 degrees of bank. And like I said, in a 60-degree bank, you're only going to pull 2 G's. So even in a 60-degree bank in a trainer like that, you're still less than half of – you're still subjecting the airplane to less than half of what it can
fascinating.
It can withstand.
It is. It's, yeah. Yeah.
I'm just – he's remarkable, the knowledge that First Officer Brian Johnson has. Well, I can't keep up with him.
Well, like you said, I mean, we're all experts, so, you know, we're
– All right. Are you ready for the next one? Instructor Bass.
Quiz time.
It seems like it. Okay. What is the wingspan of a Cessna 152?
The wingspan.
You and I both trained in them.
Right.
Yep.
The numbers up top of my head. What is the wingspan?
I want to say, I'm trying to picture in my head, 33 feet, 4 inches.
Is that 33?
Yeah.
Yep. This guy here.
This guy, he's on top of it. No,
trust me, man, I feel so rusty.
This is a good day for him, I'm telling you.
It is.
So rusty. I'm surprised I still remember all this stuff. It's still going around in my head.
I don't remember a lot of it.
Yeah.
I'm having a hard time with it. Are you ready?
Is this quiz time?
No, you're doing fine, man. Don't worry.
You're doing great. Doing better than me.
No, a lot of these things, you got to think a lot of the stuff that I've been covering in ground school is like this kind of stuff that as far as the latitude, longitude stuff and all, we don't cover a lot of that stuff. As Brian would know that you don't get all these things all the time.
Yeah.
So
right.
A lot of it's just, you're like the majority of stuff that we've been covering is navigation, flight planning, stuff like that. So a lot of the stuff that we have to research.
I remember some of these questions back when I was in flight.
Yeah, but a lot of it we have to also research some of this stuff too. Like if someone will ask me a question, if I don't know it, I can go back and actually.
Yeah, that'd be kind of embarrassing.
Yeah,
To be a ground instructor and have a student ask you a question you couldn't answer it.
Yeah, well,
embarrassing so much as far as you, but because you don't know everything. I mean, you're the expert in the area that you've been teaching. There are some things that you just some students will ask you some questions that you're like, I can go look it up, and that's what you're supposed to do.
Yeah,
because you don't want to give the student any information that's
false.
False information. That won't be good.
I think a lot of these questions sound like some of those questions that might be on a student's mind, but because they do seem like you said, some of the more obscure ones, they might not know where to find them. The questions that are important, but
yes.
Because they're new and they're students, and they don't necessarily know where to find them. You know, they, like you said, want to go to a subject matter expert like yourself with the expectation that you would know.
Yep.
So,
but there's a vast, the knowledge is so much vaster with an airline pilot versus a ground instructor. So, it's,
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, that definitely makes a because he's been flying a lot. You know, he's been flying more different airplanes, and his experience definitely is, you know, it definitely. And he's also was a CFI for how many years? You've been flying for CFI.
I first got my CFI in 2015.
Right. So there is he's definitely got a base of knowledge that's really good because he's been doing it for quite some time as well.
True, but at the same time, though, I'm not current, so
yeah. But a lot of these questions that they're asking, that you know, on top of your head, you just know, you know. Yeah.
Give yourself more credit than you are. you're definitely the subject matter. If you were to ask me maybe about airline operations, you know, that'd be my forte. But as far as instructional questions, I think you're the subject matter expert. So.
Okay, we're ready for the next question here.
Oh, sure.
All right. Deep breath. It's another crazy one.
Okay.
How can you calculate the precise maneuvering speed for a Cessna 152 flying at 1,350 pounds? First Officer Brian?
Well, I mean, you're the guest. Would you like Well, there is a calculation you can use. Did you say 1,350 pounds? So, if I remember this correctly, you take the current weight of the aircraft, you divide that by the gross weight. So in this case, for Cessna 152, 1,350 pounds divided by the gross weight of 1,670 pounds. You take the result of that. So if that's kind of back of the envelope math, like 0.8, you find the square root of that, which would be 0.89. And then you multiply that result by the maneuvering speed for the gross weight. So just to recap, 1,350 pounds divided by 1,670, which is like 0.8, find the square root of that, which is 0.89, and then you multiply 0.89 by the gross weight maneuvering speed, which is 104 knots for a Cessna 152, and that would give you 93 knots at 1,350.
All right, so, on the button. I don't know how you do this.
And that information, it depends on the aircraft manufacturer, but some manufacturers only post one maneuvering speed, which would typically be for the gross weight of the aircraft. For Cessna 152s, it happens to be 104 knots. Other manufacturers, and Cessna actually happens to be one of them, will post maneuvering speeds at different weights because ground instructor Bazzi knows.
How does he pull this off his head like that?
Well, it's just simple math.
Yeah, but if I did it with a calculator, I couldn't figure that out. Well, you know,
I mean, I don't know.
he's done it for a while, right?
Yeah. I guess so. Gosh almighty. Okay, this is a new one. There's, for the folks listening, there's a new procedure out there via air traffic control. And ground instructors, I'm pretty sure, know this, and I'm sure you know it as well, ground instructor Bazzi. What is the Climb 1000 procedure and the action to be taken when instructed by ATC?
The Climb 1 procedure?
Climb 1000.
Well, that would be, you have to at least maintain, you have to be able to climb at 1,000 feet, right? Is that it?
No, I don't think that's it. I think it's, the FAA has just instituted a new phraseology for traffic and collision avoidance.
Oh, okay.
So now...
is that instrument stuff?
Yeah.
I've been teaching a lot of VFR stuff recently, so I'm not...
Okay.
That would be the...
It's kind of a new procedure, haven't heard of it yet?
No, I have not.
Well, it's used for instrument flying, but it can also be used for aircraft under VFR flight fouling as well. So if you're flying along under ATC control, whether you're IFR... or VFR getting traffic advisories, and there's a traffic conflict, ATC can tell you to climb 1,000, which means that you're expected to immediately apply full thrust,
right?
Climb out at VX to the next
highest
magnetic cruising altitude for your direction of flight.
Fascinating.
Well, yeah, I actually never. When did they come out? I'm just curious. I don't know.
I'm not sure.
I think that's already been made effective.
Is it? Oh, yeah. I have to.
Yeah. So that's something I'd recommend telling your students.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I definitely would. I'd never heard of it until now. So,
jeez,
I
haven't either.
Sometimes you just don't. I mean,
I'm surprised, Baz. I mean, I'm not even actively instructing.
Yeah, no, I have not heard of it.
So,
Again.
We will definitely look into that. So for sure.
I'm just, it blows my mind. Yeah. The difference between an airline pilot and a ground instructor. There it is right there. You just... Know. It's just the way it is. It's just the knowledge is there, you know.
I guess so.
He's acting all like Columbo, you know.
Yep.
I'm just trying to be polite.
But we're coming to the last one here.
Oh, boy.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
This is ILS related.
Okay.
All right. What is the average width of an ILS at the approach end of a typical runway?
It'll be 12 degrees.
No, not
even close.
You might be confusing that with a VOR.
Oh, maybe.
So a VOR on average for full-scale deflection is about 12. 18 to 20 degrees, actually. 10 degrees from the center to one side, 18 and 20 degrees both sides. But an ILS is 4 to 5 times more sensitive than a VOR.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's why you notice if you're flying an ILS, just any lateral movement will make the needle swing a lot, which is why you have to be really precise. But the width of an ILS signal is going to vary based on the runway length. Typically, they'll modulate it to be about 700 feet wide at the approach end of the runway. But that could vary based on the length of the runway. Shorter runways will have a slightly wider signal. Longer runways will have a slightly narrower signal. But it's typically between 3 and 6 degrees wide at the approach end of the runway, ideally 3 degrees wide. And that'll equate to about 700 feet. Mm. You okay? You okay, Phil? You all right? Yeah. Phil's having a heart attack over here.
Yeah, I don't know why he's having a heart attack.
Phil.
I'm sorry, you guys.
I don't know what.
1, 2, and 3. Ready?
Yeah.
1, 2, 3. April Fools.
What the f- Did you guys just prank me?
We got you good, man.
You asshole. Just a prank.
Yes, it is. We're calling this episode the April Fool's Edition.
Yeah. I swear, watching you sweat was priceless.
I'm like, what the f-
Speaking to the mic, man.
all
those answers, those questions we picked beforehand, and I rehearsed the answers. I was
like, man.
He was sweating it up over there. It was great.
Really? You're gonna do this to me like that?
Oh, man. That's hilarious.
Ground instructor Bazzy.
There you go.
Most pilots would not be able to answer these questions we asked you. So don't feel bad.
Because, I'm like, what is going on here? I'm like, hey.
Actually, we've been planning this for months.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, you want to talk about some ground instruction at least?
We could do that, but I also, we're gonna switch it over. We got some time, so we're going to switch it over to more serious topics.
Mm-hmm.
Should we rehearse those questions? I'm just you actually really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we picked them out, so we kind of knew the answers beforehand. Some of them I remembered, but some of them, I definitely wouldn't have been able to tell you the world coordinates for Oakland County.
I was going to say, how did he pull that one off? I'm like, I've never. I'm like, okay, you know.
Does this bring it back to the Metatol days?
What about the Metatol days?
It brings you back. We used to do that with each other all the time.
Well, I did not expect that today, but okay. And then I totally forgot it was April Fool's Day tomorrow.
That's right.
But
that's right.
It's all good. I'll get you somehow.
We always get me back. So we'll switch it over to a more serious topic here.
Mm-hmm.
Since we have some time. I'll get both of your opinions on what's been going on with the 737 MAX aircraft. I don't know too much about it because I'm not an airline pilot, and I don't fly 73s. I'm flying Cessna 172s, which are not highly technical. What are your feelings on these airplanes?
You want to give? I can go if you want to.
Go ahead.
Well, no, I did some reading on it and obviously talking to some pilots. So I just think that... It's definitely been a. When you look at the crash, when the first crash happened, those airplanes, or at least they knew about it. That should have been taken care of right there and then. There was a bulletin that was obviously sent out by Boeing.
Mm-hmm.
But the question I have, and the question that is, I think most people, in, as even airline pilots would, is that do we have today like the training that we that's required? I mean, it seems like this seems to be going on all the time where you they would send out a bulletin, but then something else would happen. Are the pilots being trained, you know, to like you have sim time, for example? Like my, I would like to know is that when that bulletin came out, did those Ethiopian pilots receive that bulletin, and how were they? How was it corrected on the airlines, or is there something else that we're missing?
What bulletin? And
well, the Boeing sent out a service bulletin, right, when the first crash happened,
mm-hmm.
telling them that how to disconnect this system.
Oh, okay.
If it goes down, if it happens to push, you know, the nose down, but.
Mm-hmm.
Did those Ethiopian pilots receive that? I'm sure they did. And what was done by the airlines to you know, fix that as far as teaching the pilots? Or the, did they do simulator time, for example? Or did they just read the bulletin or the service bulletin?
Good question. Yeah.
What would you think of as an airline pilot? I think what would be the...
Well, I mean, you'd surely like to hope so. It's without knowing the specific training curriculum and the maintenance procedures for each individual airline, in particular foreign airlines, like this Ethiopian airline, it's hard to say exactly. Just to give the listeners a little background, there have been two recent accidents of Boeing's new 737 MAX aircraft. And the 737 MAX is the latest in a long line of the 737 family. It's a little bit different. It looks a lot like a traditional 73 on the outside, but it's a little bit different because the engines have been redesigned, so the engines are mounted further forward on the wings. And because of that, at high angles of attack, it makes the airplane actually want to nose up even more.
Yep.
So in order to give you a greater stall protection and make the aircraft easier to fly and maneuver, Boeing designed something called the MCAS, the Maneuvering Characteristics Augmentation System.
Yep.
And what it does is when you're flying with the autopilot off at high angles of attack, the MCAS automatically will nose over the aircraft, and it uses several inputs to be able to do that. Angle of attack information from the air data computers.
Well, also, but wasn't that that information on the first crash, the problem was with the angle of attack indicators, right?
Well, that you took the words right out of my mouth.
Yeah,
so the MCAS did what it was supposed to do.
But it was false information.
But it was acting based on false information.
Right.
So you had faulty inputs, faulty angle of attack, inputs, things like that. So the MCAS was acting inappropriately. When the angle of attack was not too high, it was actually nosing the aircraft over.
Sure.
And to pilots who, like you said, hadn't been trained on this, because Boeing said, well, the MCAS operates in the background. There's nothing, it doesn't affect the way the pilots fly. It's just like having a stick shaker. If you're flying a normal airplane, a normal jetliner, and you get too slow, your angle of attack gets too high, the stick shaker and eventually the stick pusher will activate. So in this in this instance, Boeing said, well, it's not going to really affect the way the pilots fly. If the angle of attack gets high enough such that it's needed, well, then the MCAS will automatically activate.
Right.
So they didn't feel the need to have to train pilots to be able to.
Yeah, and that was one of their selling points, too, I think, for to say, well, you don't really, this new, you know, 737 MAX,
mm-hmm.
It's you're not going to spend a lot of money, you know, retraining the pilots or giving them extra training. So therefore, they're like, oh, we should get that. So that's what I think Boeing. But my question also is that, I read the other day that one of the pilots reported that even when they put the autopilot on, the plane wanted to nose down. So I don't know if that's still related to it or we just don't know what's going on as far as that.
Yeah. I don't know enough about this 73 MAX to know what disconnect features they have. Like, so on the CRJ I fly, for example, we have pretty typical run-of-the-mill stick shaker and stick pusher. So we have an angle of attack computer, and it has several trip points. So when you – it'll never let you, under normal circumstances, get all the way to a full stall, a fully developed stall. The stick pusher will activate at some percentage before you reach the actual stall. So at about, let's say, 95% of the way to the stall, the stick pusher is activating. First indication or the first trip point as you're approaching this stall, our continuous ignition will activate. So basically, in jet engines, you have, like, once you ignite them and get them started, it's self-perpetuating. So you don't have to keep igniting the fuel in the combustion chamber. It keeps igniting by itself. But at high angles of attack, with the airflow to the engine being disrupted, you could actually have a flame out. So as you approach a stalling angle of attack, the first thing that happens is the angle of attack computer automatically activates the continuous ignition. So it turns the igniters back on, and we get a message saying that that's happened. Then as you get higher, if the pilot doesn't correct, it'll disconnect the autopilot automatically and activate the stick shaker. And that's the pilot's clue. Okay, well, I need to
push note, yeah,
reduce the angle of attack. And if you still don't, at about 95-ish% of the way to the stall, it'll activate the stick pusher where it will automatically nose and push the nose
right,
over.
Right, but you've also had training in that to know.
We've had training in it.
You know, that's
exactly. That's, but also we have an autopilot stick pusher connect button. So right on our yoke, there's a button we can press that, I don't know why you need to do it, but let's say if you actually needed to do it, you can actually override the stick shaker.
Right.
And keep the stick shaker from activating. So I say all that to say, I don't know if the 737 MAX has some type of override feature for the MCAS. I mean,
well, there is, they said. There is a, I don't know exactly how it is, but there's like two either buttons, or you press to disconnect it. But the crew that were flying did not, you know. But I just want to say one thing about the Ethiopian crew. Mm-hmm. That a lot of people hear that, you know, they say it's a third world country and stuff. It's actually a very respected company in Africa, and it's got a very, you know, safe, you know, record as far as air travel, because we know that African air travel is a little bit, it's been getting better, but Ethiopian Airlines is definitely a very highly regarded airline. So, I was really, you know, kind of taken back by that, because even though it was after we got the first crash, they knew what had happened, and then this thing happened again. So I guess that goes to pilot training now, and see what, you know, what are they being trained?
I don't know about pilot training. Maybe an adjustment on that system.
Well, you can adjust any system you want, but if the pilot is not aware of what's going on in his airplane, just like how I tell students all the time, like, you got to know how to operate everything in your airplane. You have to know all the equipment you're flying, and if you don't, you might be able to get by one time, second time, but the third time, you know, things may not work out that way. So know your airplane really well, and the fact that, you know, Boeing says, well, you don't need to know that, that's kind of an important thing that I would hope that, you know.
Well, that's a truth. That's a true fact, because, you know, I only fly, what, 172s, but still, every 172 I've flown has different characteristics.
Sure. It didn't.
There was one, for instance, that I enjoyed flying, but it had a lot of P factor.
Right. See, you know,
so
you know about
know
that.
You had that. Right. You have that right rudder in for most of the time. Even straight and level flight with the power back, you'd have to have that right rudder in. Because it had the P factor.
It can also be as simple as knowing how to use your audio panel on the airplane.
Absolutely.
Know, a lot of the airplanes we fly, they have different setups for different, you know, and if you don't know, you just, what is this, you know?
Right.
Using the GPS, for example, a lot of people don't, you know, they don't know how to use the GPS, students even. But there's something actually that I would like to either ask you or anyone about, what they think about what's going on with the training as far as using ForeFlight and stuff like that. Because I've seen that some examiners would let their students, you know, that use ForeFlight to do the cross-country planning.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, I just had seen that recently, because, you know, when we started flying, it was do the, you know, user charts and stuff, but some examiners are okay with that. So I don't know what, yeah, is that. Have you seen that?
Well, like I said, I haven't instructed in
over
2 years
now,
but from what I know from keeping up with the industry, there is no rule that says that a student can't use ForeFlight. It's really at the examiner's discretion.
Right.
Can I ask you guys what ForeFlight is, because I'm the old pilot here?
ForeFlight is an app for the iPad. So it replaces paper charts. It's called electronic flight bag.
That definitely puts me out of the loop.
An EFB. Yeah, so It's kind of an all-stop shop. You have electronic charts, sectional charts, yep. world aeronautical charts, terminal area charts in the app. It replaces your chart supplement, formerly known as the airport facility directory, yes. so you can pull that up. Any information, all the information about a specific airport, fuel prices, runway lengths and configuration, all that stuff.
And it's
also
got weather and everything.
Weather. You can use it to file flight plans, get weather briefings.
Wow.
You can use it for weight and balance for particular aircraft. So it's a very robust application.
Yeah, it's actually really good. It's really useful once you get to know how to use the stuff.
So is it like a is it like a flight computer?
It's
like a digital flight computer that'll do this for you, or
It has flight computer. It's not a flight computer per se. It has flight computer functions.
Yeah.
So the theory of going the interpolation side is by the wayside, like interpolating. Like back in the day, we looked at the charts.
Right. Well,
and we'd do an interpolation.
Back in the day, you even did the whole route. You did the route. You got your winds. You got everything. Now it does it for you. And so I have seen some, and I guess you're right, it is on the examiner's discretion, but I've seen some examiners, because I told one of the students the other day, I said, you know, because he's going on for a check ride, and I said, you know, well, are you going to do your flight plan, you know? so he says, oh, no, I can use ForeFlight. And I was like, okay. He says, oh, the examiner said I could.
Yeah.
So we're moving into such technology that we've got the basic.
Now, see, for an older pilot like me, that seems like cheating.
It's good. I mean, it's part of what aviation's coming to. But I still would think, and I would like to see the basic. I try to at least teach the basic of, you know, here's how, like, for example, a lot of students nowadays do not use, either like call flight service and stuff like that. They just go on ForeFlight and they go, oh, the weather looks great, so I'm good.
Yeah.
So I've been keeping the students in the habit of calling the briefers, getting the weather, getting the NOTAMs, because even the NOTAMs, you know, we all know, sometimes you have to be a scholar to interpret them. Of course, being an airline pilot now, you're used to more reading those. Yeah. But even as an airline pilot, you know, you're like, well, what's this? So I tell them, like, you know, call the briefers. They're very good, useful individuals that could really be help. You know, they can help you interpret things. And so I do it still. Every flight, I call for a briefer. I encourage the students to do it. I understand that technology is coming to this point. But yeah, most students now, they just go on ForeFlight and they look at the weather and it's all there.
Now, even with the ForeFlight, do you guys still instruct the basic way in case of a backup?
Yes.
You know, in case they need, you know, the old school knowledge.
Yep. Yep.
Because it just feels like cheating. That's kind of like, you know, I guess, you know what, I used to kind of cheat on my flight plans and everything because I used an electronic flight computer. Okay, that was technically cheating. That did the work for me, but this seems like all out.
The idea of technology, as Brian could tell you, even in the airplane, is it's supposed to reduce certain things. It was reduce and it is a great
reduce
tool.
Time or
well,
it gives you greater utility.
Yeah, you got. Yeah. I mean, like GPS, for example. You know, what's the purpose of the GPS? A lot of times, if we have situational awareness, we know where we're at. You know, instead of having a paper chart, where am I? At a glance, you know where you're at.
Where's Cackleberry Airport?
Yeah. So instead of us, you know, when we flew, it was like, well, where is that? Is that lake look like this lake or the other lake? Or so it certainly helps a lot, and it helps your students, you know. But like I encourage them to even carry extra charts with them, just in case, you know, your iPad or your phone or it goes dead. You know, you have a backup as well. So definitely been an interesting transition for what's going on
now.
Even the glass cockpits too.
Yeah.
As a ground instructor go ahead.
No, you can go ahead.
You as a ground instructor, you as a flight instructor. I just want to know, what is the percentage of students now or private pilots and VFR that use flight following? Has that decreased?
I have seen it decreased. But I have encouraged a lot of students to keep doing it, because it, number one, what it does, and it's first of all, it's a great service because there's somebody there monitoring you. If something happens, you know, you have somebody there that you can talk to, and it's definitely an extra eye in the sky. So why not use it? It's free. You're not going to pay for it.
Well, you know? You're already paying for it with your tax dollars.
Well, I mean, well, you know.
But I know.
And that brings me to this question. Here, the interviewer in me. How is the fight against privatization of ATC going? Because I know that they were talking about user fees.
Right. Yeah, like, how's like that going? Other countries, right?
Well, no, they were talking about it in the United States.
You're right, but other countries have user fees. And the idea, if you got user fees, is, you know, is it, you know, then people are not going to use them as much. So therefore, where's the safety? I know the AUPA has been fighting that.
They've been fighting it for years, but is the fight still strong?
So far, they've held them at bay.
Yeah.
I don't think that there's any plans in the immediate future to institute user fees, but they're always looming in the government budget. Because the idea with the government is, you know, right now the Federal Aviation Administration is publicly funded. Most of the control towers out there are publicly funded at taxpayer expense. And so in the government's effort to streamline cost, they're looking to institute user fees, which will kind of be like, if our listeners can think of it akin to toll roads, you know, whereas your typical highway is publicly funded. Well, with the toll road, it's partially funded by you paying a toll. So only those who use the highway pay the toll. People who don't use it don't have to pay. So in a way, it kind of makes sense. But at the same time, it'll definitely make general aviation more expensive for the vast majority of pilots. I'm personally opposed to it because I think there's a negative perception about general aviation being kind of like an exclusive club. But it's really not. Even though less than 1% of the population are pilots and 99% of the population are not flying general aviation airplanes on a regular basis, general aviation still brings so much to our economy, aside from airline travel, that it's still beneficial, I think, to the general public. I mean, if you think about so many avenues that general aviation provides, you know, if you got a small town out in the middle of nowhere and you put a small general aviation airport in that in that area, definitely, in the county, well, now you've just opened up your economy to lots of travelers. You
know? A lot of the smaller airports are closing. That's the problem. There's so many. There used to be a ton of airports in Southeast Lower Michigan that are closed now.
A lot of places are definitely being.
There used to be an airport close to the Salem VOR called Salem.
Yes, and
that's closed. You know,
that was before our time, but it, definitely a lot of places have definitely closed. The one thing though that I've seen is that because of the pilot shortage, and that we have this young generation, what I try to do with the flight school is we try, you know, we're trying to promote aviation. That's our number one, our biggest thing. You know, is that. Because let's face it, flight school is never going to make money, right? The point of the flight school is to promote aviation and have these young, you know, because everybody now is it's either the generation that's growing up, they're on video games, they're not, you know, and what I'm trying to do is to promote it, to bring that back, that you know, like when we were at Metatel, right? We used to go hang out. It was fun. It was a great time. It was a bunch of good people, a bunch of good guys. We grew up around that. And,
right.
And we had that, you know, that really, you know, kind of cozy home flight school airport, you know.
Right.
And that's, you know, you've been up to where I work and you see how it is.
Absolutely. It's
definitely. It's
getting there. It's getting there. It's getting similar to what it was at Metatel.
And I'm really trying to push for that. Because that's how I grew up. I grew up among pilots as being my heroes, being people I looked up to. And, you know, for me, it's the joy of aviation is to see someone just kind of look at planes and go, wow, you know, that's what I want to do.
Kids in particular, I have some friends who have kids who want to go up. So we're kind of encouraging kids to get into it because they're the generation that are more into their phones and they haven't seen the world around their phones. And if they get up in an airplane and could see it, it might change their perspective.
Yeah, flying is definitely, and now, like at the pilot shortage too, that's a big one now because there are a lot of jobs you can get. I mean, we don't have enough instructors and we don't have enough people working because it's, you know, they become instructors, then they go into the airlines and then they move up and then, you know.
They leave. Yeah,
and there's this country is great. I just want to tell people that I feel that the opportunities you have in this country to become a pilot are really great.
Much better than Europe.
Much better than a lot of places in the world.
Europe's
because
expensive.
It's expensive, and here it's definitely been a great it's a great nation to fly in because you have such good opportunities, and if you work hard at it, as Brian knows and as you know, you will become a pilot. And I encourage a lot of these young guys or listeners that want to become pilots, go and do it. This is the time to do it. And if you're healthy, if you have good training, and you'll be able to get a job. And that's how aviation is nowadays. It's really great.
That sounds awesome. I wanted to go back to that. What was that? Four flight?
Yes.
The four flight and flight planning and flight following.
Yep.
You said that's decreased.
Yes.
So we need
to get... I've seen it that way.
I enjoyed using flight following because when I was 11 or 12 years old, I was listening to air traffic control on my scanner.
Yeah.
And it just excited me, the radio portion of it. So anytime I would get into an airplane, mm-hmm. I wanted to be on the radio.
I'm still the same way.
So I would use flight following as an excuse to talk on the radio.
Yeah, it's cool. It's kind of cool. I felt like I'm pretty cool. You talk a certain way, and and people have to remember, and students especially, is that the air traffic controllers, they're there to help you. They're not there to hinder you or to yell at you, and they really are. And I encourage, actually, and what I do is I take when students come in and they're interested in flying, and when they start flying, I take them up in the tower, for example, and I make them I introduce them to the controllers. That way, they have a face now they could put in, and that know this person is there, and it's really cool. I encourage a lot of people to actually even pilots now or visit the control towers, and if you're not comfortable on a radio, practice.
Absolutely.
A lot of people are afraid to talk on the radio. Go out there and practice, and just keep in mind that they're humans like you, and that they're there to help you, and they have such great services. I mean, and when you need them, they're there. I mean, that's just a wonderful thing.
Well, First Officer Brian and I were talking about his students, and we were comparing controlled airports to non-controlled airports. Okay.
Yep.
And some of the students were more comfortable at the controlled airports. Some were more comfortable at the uncontrolled airports. Mm-hmm. And if you switch...
Pilot controlled. Yeah. I think it's a better word.
What is it?
Pilot controlled airports.
Is that what it's called now? See, I'm old.
Yeah.
So if you switch it around the other way, it's more difficult for one set of students than it is others to go the opposite way.
Right.
So when I was a student, I tried to always keep it even.
That's a good one, yes.
I started off at a controlled airport, which was Pontiac.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Then in my midstream of training, I flew, got instructed out of Big Beaver Airport, which is uncontrolled. And then I ended up ultimately down at Willow Run finishing up.
Yeah.
So I had experience in both types of airports.
And ideally, you're supposed to. I mean, that's what, you fly in the system. It's almost like saying, well, I'm going to fly here to here, but I want to avoid this airspace. Well, some people are like that. But the point is, if you practice, and I think what you just said is perfect, because there are people who say, well, I just want to stay uncontrolled. Well, I personally think that to get comfortable at a place, like at a controlled tower, for example, right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people, they just don't want to take the time and just, like, I talk to students on the ground, for example. Say, before you go out, let's do some radio work. If you feel that you're weak, I'll practice it. And also what helps too is listening to atclive.net.
Oh, yeah, that would help.
I don't know
students.
If that was...
absolutely. Learn the lingo.
Listen to lingo and practice. But I do think the idea of mixing it up is definitely a good thing.
Well, I remember when I was doing... I told the story when I did a solo episode when I was flying from Willow Run to Hillsdale.
Yep.
Okay. I was doing flight following and my directional gyro went it started spinning. Well, I'm a student pilot. Sure, it's VFR, but I still don't know what the heck I'm doing. So what happened was ATC gave me a no gyro approach.
Right.
Whereas they tell you you know, how to, what direction to turn, how many degrees, when to stop, and where the airport will be. It's great. That's what I mean. If you have that under your belt, during flight following, something happens.
And here's the thing to remember too: a lot of these controllers, they like these kind of things. So if you can ask them, I want to practice an Ojira approach, because they probably don't, they don't do them very often. So they like that. And controllers actually, you know, if you're flying around the pattern, for example, at controlled field, they like that, because it, you know, justifies them being there, and they'll often say thanks for the you know, for the pattern work, or
absolutely.
And also one thing to remember, if you are going to talk to our traffic controllers, is if you're a student, just say I'm a student pilot, you know, and they'll
that's one thing I didn't mention.
They'll really help you and keep you, you know, they'll know, okay.
Say,
you know,
Cessna 69 or 120 with you, like flight following, student pilot.
Yep.
And then bam, they'll
help you out. If you file a flight plan, you could put in the remarks section that you, if you are going to file a flight plan, which most people, a lot of people don't, some people do. If you do, just put student pilot in that, you know, and
let's go on a real quick, and then before we end it, the importance of a flight plan and flight following together.
Mm-hmm.
That the flight plan is they're going to be able to, in case of emergency, if you don't now correct me if I'm wrong, is it if you don't, if you land and you, and they don't hear from you within a half an hour, is it still 30 minutes
after?
They'll
correct.
Send the civil air patrol out.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's an escalating sequence of events. So when you file your flight plan, you give them your estimated time of departure and arrival, and if you don't call to close your flight plan within 30 minutes after that estimated time of arrival, they'll try to call you. They'll try to get a hold of the FBO.
Or the flight school. Yeah, or whoever, they'll you know.
I mean, sending out, you know, scrambling rescue is like the last resort.
Yeah,
but
they'll usually call. The Air Force generally will.
And having the flight following, they're going to have you on radar because they're going to give you a squawk code.
Correct.
And they're going to know your last position on radar.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So that's going to help with the search and rescue.
What's going to help too is they know where you're at. And in an emergency, doing flight following, you know, he's a click of a button away when you have something going on. Instead of going to 121.5 and, you know, there's somebody there, right?
Yeah.
You know, right there and then. That way you can focus on what the emergency is, and then you not have to worry about where am I, who am I talking to. You know, he's just tell me where you're at. Obviously, always fly the airplane first, right? Fly the airplane, do your emergency, then talk. But if you got time, obviously you're going to do that, and they're right there, and then they'll be able to help you in any situation that might assistance, basically.
Ground instructor Bazzi, it was great having you.
Thank you.
You were a great sport.
Yeah.
And you guys pranked me, so whatever.
Yeah.
It's all good.
Yeah, I think we got you pretty good. Yeah. We didn't want to keep it going too long.
No, that's all right. Then, you know? Yeah. I would like to come back here again and talk about other topics.
Absolutely.
Definitely would love to do that. This has been fun. It's my first one, so.
We will do that, and we'll bring you on probably even the next episode if you want to come on.
Absolutely.
With the other
guys. This is aviation has definitely been an intro. It's great, and thank you for having me. So
it
no
is.
Problem.
Yeah.
So for this this episode of Pi Reps, this is Private Pilot Phil, and for First Officer Brian Johnson and Ground Instructor Bazzi. Have a great night.
Take care, folks.
Thanks, guys.